Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
La cataracte est la principale cause de cécité évitable au monde. Le métavers peut aider à traiter ce problème. La plateforme de réalité virtuelle, conçue par Fundamental VR et Orbis International, contribue à former des médecins au traitement de la cataracte, pour que davantage de chirurgiens puissent opérer en toute confiance dans le monde entier. Avec la formation en réalité virtuelle, les chirurgiens peuvent s'entraîner encore et encore pour acquérir des compétences. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 26th of March, these are our main stories. Palestinians welcome a UN Security Council vote demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Over 100,000 Palestinians killed and maimed for this council to vote for humanity to prevail, for life to prevail.
11 days after leaving jail, Senegal's opposition leader Bassirou Diomaye Faye looks set to win the presidential election. And Donald Trump is set to face a criminal trial next month as his lawyers fail to delay the case. Also in this podcast, President Putin says radical Islamists carried out Friday's deadly attack on a Moscow concert hall, but again links the suspected attackers to Ukraine. And
if I was Oliver Coleman, I'd be earning a lot more than I am. I know of one pay disparity, which is a 12,000% difference.
12,000%?
Wow. I'll tell
you
about that later.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
The Oscar-winning actress Olivia Coleman on the pay gap between male and female actors. Could this be a pivotal moment in what is nearly 6 months of war in Gaza? The United Nations Security Council has, for the first time, adopted a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. It's the first time the world's top diplomatic body has called for a halt to the fighting since Israel began its military offensive. Critically, Israel's closest ally and military supporter, the United States, chose not to block the motion. Our first report comes from our North America correspondent, John Sudworth.
After months of diplomatic wrangling, geopolitical brinkmanship, squabbling over semantics and numerous failed attempts, a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza has finally been passed.
The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2728.
As well as the call for an immediate ceasefire, the resolution demands the release of the Israeli hostages held by Hamas and an urgent expansion of humanitarian aid. And the applause was a sign that many members felt it was long overdue, with France's ambassador to the UN pointing to what he called the Security Council's deafening silence on Gaza. But the UK, while voting in support, said it regretted that the resolution did not explicitly condemn the October the 7th attacks by Hamas, and it was a theme taken up by the Israeli ambassador, Gilad Erdan, in his response to the resolution, condemning what he called the failure to make the call for a ceasefire conditional upon the release of hostages.
Your demand for a ceasefire not only is not helpful, but it undermines the efforts to secure their release. It is harmful to these efforts because it gives Hamas's terrorists, the hope to get a ceasefire without releasing the hostages.
Previous resolutions have foundered on the vetoes of the Security Council's permanent members, the US on three occasions, and Russia and China wielding theirs just last week. But this time, in a sign of Washington's growing frustration over the way Israel is prosecuting the war, the US ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, only abstained, allowing the vote to go through.
We did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution. And we believe it was important for the Council to speak out and make clear that any ceasefire must come with the release of all hostages.
Palestine's permanent observer at the UN said the resolution now needs to be implemented. It needs to be a turning point, he said. But with Israel saying it intends to push ahead with the war, the vote, while high on symbolism, may well turn out to be low on substance.
The UN vote intensifies the pressure on the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen is in Jerusalem and has this analysis of a key diplomatic moment.
The US decision not to block the ceasefire resolution removes, for now, diplomatic protection from Israel at the UN Security Council. After the vote, the American ambassador to the Security Council called the resolution non-binding. Usually, Security Council resolutions are considered to carry the force of law. For weeks, President Joe Biden and his senior officials have indicated that they're losing patience with the way Israel is fighting the war in Gaza. President Biden wants the hostages out as well as the destruction of Hamas as a military force, but he's been telling Israel to respect international humanitarian law, which includes an obligation to protect civilians. The Israelis deny they block humanitarian aid, but the Americans can see the evidence that Gaza is on the brink of famine, with children dying of hunger a few miles from ample stores of food in Israel and Egypt. The U.S.-Israel alliance is deep, but at times it is highly dysfunctional. Crises happen when Israel defies the wishes of American presidents and what the White House sees as U.S. interests. No crisis in the long U.S.-Israel alliance has been more serious than the one that's developed in almost 6 months of war in Gaza.
Jeremy Bowen, and we'll be returning to this story later in the Global News podcast. With a delayed election, the opposition candidate in jail and violent street protests, it wasn't inevitable that Sunday's presidential election in Senegal would be free and fair. But democracy seems to have won the day. The governing coalition has conceded defeat and the next president will be Bassirou Diomaye Faye, who campaigned from prison on a promise of radical change. As early results suggested he was in the lead, Mr. Faye's supporters began celebrating. Our correspondent Thomas Nardi is there.
It's a huge relief for the people of this country. I'm currently out on the streets of Dakar. Normalcy has returned. People are happy. And, the fact that the ruling party candidate has congratulated Mr. Diomaye is very significant. And also President Macky Sall has done the same and said that this is a victory for the country's democracy, and which is also important because the run-up to the election was marred by violent protests with clashes between the police and the youth of this country. Now, before the Electoral Commission announces the official results, people have been out on the streets to celebrate the victory of Mr. Faye and the triumph of democracy in this country.
So what will Mr. Diomaye Faye's main challenges be when he takes over as president?
Senegal has a very youthful population with a median age of 19. Unemployment is a huge problem here. That will be one of his priorities. It has forced many to embark on dangerous journey to Europe to seek greener pastures. There's also a cost of living crisis, which has affected many families. And of course, institutional reforms to safeguard the country's democracy. But that is not all. Senegal hopes to begin oil and gas production by the end of this year. And Diomaye Faye has promised to renegotiate all energy contracts in this country.
He has significant support for his presidency then?
Certainly. He's enjoying a lot of support from the country's youth, backed by a firebrand opposition candidate Ousmane Sonko. He also enjoys a lot of support from the diaspora. And many are hopeful that when he comes to power, he'll be able to address some of the concerns of this country.
Thomas Nardi in Senegal. In New York, two separate court decisions have been made in relation to Donald Trump. First, we now have a date for when he'll go to trial over alleged hush money paid to porn star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. It will start on April the 15th, just as Mr. Trump gears up for another presidential campaign. In the other case, an appeals court has reduced the bond payment Mr. Trump has to make in a civil fraud appeal by more than half to $175 million and given him an extra 10 days to find the money. Originally, he was ordered to find $464 million, which he said was impossible. Neda Torfik has more from New York.
Donald Trump's legal team has sought to delay as much as possible the various trials he is facing. And the district attorney here in New York accused him of doing exactly that in this case, applying just in January to subpoena some extra documents from Michael Cohen, his former fixer, that's really at the center of this hush money case. He was the one that he paid back for paying the former porn star Stormy Daniels, allegedly, according to prosecutors here in New York. Now, because of that, there was this long hearing back and forth about how long this trial should be delayed. But the judge was quite angry about some of the arguments that Donald Trump's team put forward about there being prosecutorial misconduct, essentially alluded to the fact that he thought that was completely unfounded. So instead, he granted the 30-day delay that the district attorney had agreed to, saying because there were more documents that were furnished by federal prosecutors, it wouldn't take 90 days, as Donald Trump wanted, to go through all of those. So we do now have a trial date set, April 15th, and that makes it pretty certain, unless anything else changes, that voters will know before November whether Donald Trump will be a convicted felon in this case or acquitted of the charges against him.
Neda Torfik. There's been a striking rise in cancers among the under-50s. One recent study found an almost 80% rise worldwide in early-onset cancer over the last three decades. That is a global figure, but the highest rates of early-onset cancers are in wealthy countries. Lauren Fresser from Wales was diagnosed with bowel cancer in 2021 when she was 33.
I went to my GP a lot and it didn't get any better, asking them for more investigation and that didn't happen. And it was only due to my stubbornness, really, taking myself to hospital, and I ended up in emergency surgery, and I was told that another 24 hours and my bowel would have completely ruptured and killed me. And I was also pregnant at the time, which unfortunately that baby died. There is this guard up of, you know, you're too young for certain tests, but you have to advocate for yourself, which is a shame because, as the report says, this is now becoming so much more prevalent among people and particularly women as well.
The findings come just days after the Princess of Wales revealed that she was diagnosed with a form of cancer after undergoing abdominal surgery in January. My colleague Evan Davis spoke about the latest research to Helen Coleman, a professor of cancer epidemiology at Queen's University Belfast.
There was a 20% increase in cancers being diagnosed in people aged 18 to 49. That's comparing 2019 data to the early 1990s. And similar increases have been noted in other Western countries around the world.
Something is going on there. Must be diet. No, what is it?
A short answer is we know, but there are two potential explanations. So one is that risk factors we know about, like tobacco smoking, alcohol exposure, being overweight or obese, that we are potentially being exposed to those earlier in our lives and therefore more likely to get cancer at an earlier age, or that it's a generational effect and that this generation have been exposed to changes in our environment or other changes in our lifestyle that are causing these cancers and we don't yet know what they are. For example, changes in exposure to chemicals, changes in the medications that we take, antibiotics has been hypothesised, or changes in our diet, for example, processed foods. But it's really important to say that we don't have good enough data to be definitive about any of those.
Is there a changing pattern of the kinds of cancers that we're seeing people get?
Yes, this is the other thing that's very concerning. In that age group between 18 and 49, we see different cancers for men than we do for women. So traditionally in men, you would have seen cancers like testicular cancer, lymphoma. In women, by far and away, the most prevalent cancer being diagnosed in that age group is premenopausal breast cancer. So that would account for about 4 in 10. But we are seeing a rise in digestive cancers, like bile cancer in particular, is causing concern around the world. For example, the USA has lowered their bile cancer screening age eligibility to 45 in response to this.
It's not a diagnosis thing. It's not that we talk about cancer much more. We're much more aware of it. People go and get diagnosed, maybe for cancers that would have existed untreated and maybe not very dangerously? Is it anything like that going on?
It's a good question. I don't think that is the answer here. We do think this is a genuine rise because we are seeing it across all age groups, people in their 20s, 30s, particularly people in their 40s. But the other thing is we only have a screening program for cervical cancer in women from the age of 25. There's no other screening program done in this age group. And there's no particular reason why people would come forward now more than they used to. However, that's what we want to happen as a result of this awareness raising. So if people are at home and are experiencing symptoms that are unusual for them, please contact their GP.
And don't think, oh, cancer won't be affecting me because I'm 30.
Yeah, never too young, unfortunately. This rise in people aged 18 to 49 is much higher than the rise we're seeing in older age groups. Go and get checked out. The likelihood of it being cancer is low, but if it is cancer, it's better that you know about it and that you're diagnosed early because treatment is much more successful.
Professor Helen Coleman speaking to Evan Davis. The UK has blamed China for interfering in Britain's democracy by carrying out two malicious cyber campaigns in 2021. One was aimed at MPs who were critical of China, and the other was against the Electoral Commission, in which the personal details of 40 million voters were accessed. Britain's Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden, told Parliament that this signalled hostile behaviour from China and that the government was taking steps to address the threat.
We are today acting to warn of the breadth of targeting emanating from Chinese state-affiliated actors like APT 31, to sanction those actors who attempt to threaten our democratic institutions, and to deter both China and all those who seek to do the same.
Earlier, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry, Lin Jian, preempted the announcement by issuing this warning.
Cybersecurity is a global challenge. The tracking of origins of cyber attacks is highly sensitive and complicated. They must be fully backed up with objective evidence, and one should not pin the blame on some certain countries without any factual basis, let alone politicise this issue. We hope that parties can stop spreading this information and take a responsible attitude and jointly safeguard security and peace of cyberspace.
I asked our UK political correspondent Rob Watson if British voters should be worried.
No, according to the government, Alex, but it was a slightly contradictory message from Mr. Dowden, who you heard from a second ago, in that he was saying, look, and the words were exactly, Alex, I want to reassure people that the compromise of this information, while concerning, does not create a risk to those affected. So a reassurance, Britain's democracy is safe. But on the other hand, he also said, I do urge institutions, corporations, everybody in the UK to be aware of the scale of the threat.
So the UK is introducing sanctions on two people and summoning the Chinese ambassador. Is China going to care?
It's a very good question. I mean, let's just take China's response. You heard a bit of it there. We also had a response from the embassy here in London saying that this was spreading false information, that Britain was engaged in an anti-China political farce. So they clearly don't enjoy it. Whether it changes their behaviour is another question. And of course, what critics of Britain's China policy, those who take up, want a harder line, including many, of course, on the governing Conservative Party benches, say is, look, you know, why on earth would China care about a couple of people being sanctioned and one very tiny company? And one of those MPs who'd been targeted by China and who takes a pretty tough line, a man called Ian Duncan Smith, he sort of ridiculed the British government's approach, saying, I think the words were, Alex, that it was like watching an elephant giving birth to a mouse.
Britain still wants to do business with China, though. How realistic is that?
Again, it's a very good question. And look, Britain is confronting the same sort of dilemma that lots of other Western European countries have. And that is to see if you consider their policy credible, a policy which is, on the one hand, we want to engage, trade, do business with China, cooperate on things like climate change, but also to challenge China on issues like espionage and human rights. Now, critics of that sort of approach, and it's not just Britain taking that approach, but other Western countries will say, come on, you just can't really do that. That's just not going to work. But of course, Western governments like the British government would say, well, come up with a better idea then.
Rob Watson. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
Chief Executive David Calhoun, he says he's going to step down at the end of this year. Stan Deal, he's the head of the division that makes the planes for commercial customers. He's going to retire immediately.
Boeing takes drastic measures to salvage its aviation safety record. President Putin has said radical Islamists carried out Friday's deadly attack on a Moscow concert hall that left at least 139 people dead and scores injured. But he has again claimed that the suspected attackers tried to flee to Ukraine, an allegation that Kyiv has dismissed as ridiculous. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
3 days have passed since both the massacre itself at the Krokus City concert hall and the first claim of responsibility by the militant group Islamic State. That's the length of time it's taken President Putin to pin the blame on radical Islamists. Earlier in the day, the Kremlin had refused to answer a question about the Islamic State's claim. The group has published graphic footage of the attack. But Mr. Putin appears determined to pursue what he's claimed is a link to Ukraine, despite providing no concrete evidence of one. Russia says the four suspected perpetrators, all Tajik nationals, were arrested in Bryansk, a region that borders both Ukraine and Belarus. Kyiv has emphatically rejected attempts by Russian officials to link it to the attack. It and its allies have warned Russia against trying to exploit the atrocity spuriously, fearing Mr. Putin will try to use it to justify a further escalation of his war in Ukraine. Meanwhile, a Russian court has remanded in custody three other men, all members of the same family, whom investigators have also linked to the attack. Their two brothers, who are Russian citizens, and their father, a Tajik national resident in Russia.
Danny Eberhardt. Let's return to our top story, the UN Security Council's adoption of a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. 14 countries voted in favour, with none against, while the US abstained. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the US decision not to use its veto was a clear retreat from its previous position, and he cancelled a planned visit to Washington by a high-level delegation in protest. Speaking at a news conference, the White House spokesman John Kirby insisted that the US policy on Gaza remained the same.
It does not represent a change at all in our policy. And we get to decide what our policy is. The Prime Minister's office seems to be indicating through public statements that we somehow changed here. We haven't. It seems like the Prime Minister's office is choosing to create a perception of daylight here when they don't need to do that.
Hamas welcomed the resolution, while the Palestinian envoy to the UN, Riyad Mansour, said it should be a turning point in ending the war.
It has taken 6 months, over 100,000 Palestinians killed and maimed, 2 million displaced, and famine for this council to finally demand an immediate ceasefire. A vote for humanity to prevail, for life to prevail. Their ordeal must come to an end now.
On Monday, the main UN agency for Gaza, UNRWA, said it had been blocked from delivering food to northern areas of the territory, accusing Israel of intentionally obstructing aid. Israel has accused UNRWA of links with Hamas. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been speaking to the Israeli army at a new aid crossing point on the Gaza border.
Gate 96 is little more than a hole in the border fence, but it leads straight into northern Gaza, where the warnings of famine are most acute. We watch as 7 aid trucks line up to cross in under the boom of outgoing artillery. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that Gaza faces an approaching famine.
Palestinians in Gaza desperately need what has been promised, a flood of aid, not trickles, not drops. Some progress has been made, but much more needs to be done. Making that happen requires Israel removing the remaining obstacles and choke points to relief.
Gate 96 lets convoys bypass active conflict zones and destruction inside Gaza. But Israel says it won't allow any deliveries there from Gaza's main relief agency, UNRWA, saying the agency is linked to Hamas. UNRWA's director said it was outrageous and accused Israel of intentionally obstructing aid. At the border fence, Colonel Moshe Tetro, the chief aid coordinator for the Israeli army, or IDF, told me that the only limits on aid came from aid agencies themselves.
The IDF, we took a lot of measures in order to enlarge the amount of humanitarian aid, but the UN and other international organizations have some bottlenecks. They have issues and challenges regarding logistics of amount of trucks, amount of truck drivers, manpower, etc.
He pointed to the trucks waiting to cross, saying the evidence was right in front of us. 20 trucks had been approved to cross that night, he said, but only 7 showed up.
On this particular convoy, we were given a limit of 15 vetted drivers by the IDF that were cleared to use this route, but only 7 were available to us. Some had already gone up to Gaza City the day before, and they simply hadn't been able to return yet.
Matt Hollingworth, country director for the World Food Programme, was on board one of those trucks. He told me that Israel had approved just 15 drivers for this new route and that half were stuck in Gaza City.
We literally need 50, 60, 70, 80 truck drivers cleared to use these routes every single day. We need more entry points to northern Gaza and Gaza City, and we need early approvals so that we can run multiple convoys every single day.
Colonel Tetro tells me there's no shortage of food in Gaza, and that if Hamas wants to change the situation there, they should end the war.
Do you think children are starving in Gaza?
I know that they are not.
So when you see those pictures of children starving in hospital, what do you think?
I say it, and I will say it again. As much as I know, there is no starvation in Gaza.
The crossing point opens and the trucks move off into the darkness on the other side of the fence. Israel is keen to show the world it's allowing more aid into Gaza, but says it's not responsible for the amount going in. International law says different, that Israel has a duty not just to open the gates, but to get food and medicine to the people under its control.
Lucy Williamson with that report. The boss of the world's second largest aeroplane manufacturer, Boeing, has announced he's leaving after a string of serious safety failures. Dave Calhoun's announcement comes less than 3 months after a door on a Boeing plane blew out shortly after takeoff. Our North America business correspondent is Michelle Fleury.
You've got the chief executive, David Calhoun. He says he's going to step down at the end of this year. His department is part of this broader management shakeup, because you've also got Stan Deal. He's the head of the division that makes the planes for commercial customers. He's going to retire immediately and is going to be replaced by someone called Stephanie Pope. You've got the company also announcing that its chairman, Larry Kellner, will not stand for re-election to the board in May, because Boeing is grappling with its most significant safety crisis in years. And it's a crisis that really has left its customers very frustrated. Last week, apparently, a group of US airline CEOs sought meetings with Boeing directors to express their concern over what has been going on, starting, you may recall recently, with that Alaska Airlines incident when a kind of door plug fell out. And it's an unusual sign. You don't typically see that frustration with the manufacturer. And I think this was an attempt by management to try and restore faith. The initial reaction has been positive. Analysts and investors say this is a good thing for Boeing. It's a step forward in their trying to sort of regain confidence. But if you listen to what analysts are saying, they say a lot depends on who is chosen as Calhoun's successor. And will that be enough to change the company's culture from the top? If you look at this, a once great company is not so great, and we're kind of seeing these attempts to right the ship.
Michelle Fleury. Dutch darts is grappling with the issue of a trans woman competing in the sport. Two of its players have decided to quit the Netherlands women's team after the National Association backed trans woman Noah Lynn van Leuven to compete. Our correspondent in the Netherlands, Anna Holligan, told me more about the two players and why they chose to leave.
We're talking about two big names in women's darts here. So Anke Zylstra and Elaine de Graaf announced they were boycotting international duty. So they're basically not making themselves available because they don't want to play alongside their transgender teammate, Noelin van Leuven. Zylstra, she's currently ranked 12th by the World Darts Federation. She posted a statement on Facebook over the weekend, which the Dutch Darts Association responded to today. She said she made this decision with pain in her heart, and that when the time comes, you're embarrassed to turn out for the Netherlands because a biological man is playing for the women's team, then you know it's time to go. She said sport needs a fair and level playing field. Her colleague, number two, De Graaf, and she said, if someone doesn't feel good in the body they were born in, I encourage everyone to change that and be happy. I just don't think it's right for a biological man to throw for women or vice versa. It's either mixed or not.
So what has Noah Lynn van Leeuwen said?
As you can imagine, it's been an emotional strain. She says it's taken up a lot of energy, but she pointed out the choice was theirs and not hers. All of this has come in the middle of a role for her. She just made history by becoming the first transgender darts player to win tournaments playing against both men and women in the same week, one in Germany, one in England. And we should just say the Dutch Darts Federation rules state that trans women are eligible to play in the women's category if a doctor has confirmed they've been undergoing gender treatment for at least a year.
So what's the reaction to all this been more generally in the Netherlands, in the press and amongst darts fans?
Darts is massive here, amateur level, also professionally. So the story has been making a lot of headlines. Dutch Darts Association says it regrets the decision by the two, but it has defended van Leeuwen, who's currently the women's world number six, saying it was known she has completed her transition. And also there are other sports players, retired sports players getting involved. So it's a contentious issue, but she is remaining in the Dutch team.
Our correspondent in the Netherlands, Anna Holligan. And finally, the Oscar-winning actress Olivia Colman has said that she would be paid a lot more if she were a man. The latest top 10 list of the best-paid actors contains just two women. Our culture reporter Guy Lambert has more details.
The topic of equal pay in Hollywood has been the subject of ongoing discussion for many years. The debate worked its way firmly into the spotlight after an email hack of Sony executives in 2014, which revealed that Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams were paid less than their male co-stars for American Hustle. Lawrence later wrote she didn't push for more during negotiations because she didn't want to seem difficult or spoiled. When Kevin Spacey was dropped from the film All the Money in the World following allegations against him, it was revealed that the actor Mark Wahlberg was paid $1.5 million to do reshoots, while co-star Michelle Williams received just $80 a day in expenses. Olivia Colman cemented her place as a Hollywood A-lister in 2019 when she won the Best Actress Oscar for playing Queen Anne in The Favourite. She's the latest star to comment on gender pay inequality, telling CNN's Christiane Amanpour that research suggests that women have always been big box office draws, but studio executives don't see it that way.
I'm very aware that if I was Oliver Colman, I'd be earning a lot more than I am. I know of one pay disparity, which is a 12,000% difference.
12,000%?
Wow. I'll tell
you
about that later.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, do the maths, I know.
The emergence of the hashtag MeToo movement brought the treatment of women in Hollywood under the microscope. Whether Olivia Colman's comments will change anything remains to be seen.
Guy Lambert. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.